Court will now call Harold John Thomas versus estate. Henderson.
Good to be back in the courthouse.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
It pleases the court. I represent the appellant, Harold John Thomas, who was convicted of aggravated sexual assault of a child of his daughter, who allegedly was, these assaults occurred between 3 and 5 years of age. And because of a prior sexual assault conviction, the sentence was what we would call an automatic life. Most of the points of error, such as sufficiency of evidence, juror commitment questions, have been before you many times, and a lot of that's been decided against us many times, but we're going to keep raising it. It doesn't mean we're waiving those issues. I'm going to focus in the argument on, I believe it's the issues regarding evidence that was, it'd be 4 and 5, I'm sorry, it's points 4 and 5 regarding the court's not granting a mistrial after deciding some evidence was irrelevant, and for overruling our objection to testimony on its relevancy. And I may, if time permits, talk about issue number 8. 7. There was a big fight over the in the trial record over admitting the testimony of Carrie Pascal. We had a voir dire outside the presence of the jury. Lengthy discussion as to whether or not she was part of a rolling outcry theory to get that evidence in. The trial court, we believe, correctly determined that she was not an outcry evidence. She was not an outcry witness and excluded it. Despite that, the prosecutor still called her to say, I'm a child. She was a child forensic investigator who conducted an interview and then turned the results over for criminal prosecution. We objected to the fact that it was turned over for criminal prosecution, and the trial court sustained the objection, gave the jury an instruction to disregard it, but refused to grant a mistrial. We would say, it was sort of the old skunk in the jury box argument, that obviously that they were trying to show that if she was a forensic child investigator and had interviewed this child, that something must have been obtained in the way of evidence to be used against the defendant. And we think that by putting her on and asking those questions, that they had committed what we would call a fundamental error, and the only way to stop that kind of thing is to reverse it. And I think the state also ties with that a harmful error rule. I mean, the only reason they're asking the question is to harm the defendant and try to get evidence in. And unless we stop these kinds of practices, they're going to continue to do it. I think this court's seen record after record where these kinds of things happen. In addition, it seems to be the practice, and it was in this case, that they call the investigating detective in who discusses what he did, and he conducted an investigation and then filed a charge or goes and gets a warrant. And I believe the actual language in this particular trial was that he filed a charge. When you file a charge, basically you're getting a warrant and charging the person. Again, that has no relevance whatsoever. That means that the detective got probable cause to go get an arrest. Well, that's less proof than is required for a grand jury to indict somebody, and we certainly don't allow, we certainly agree that an indictment is no evidence of guilt whatsoever, So the fact that a detective has filed a charge against somebody is no evidence whatsoever again. And this particular objection was overruled, and the jury was allowed to consider it. But think, if you're a juror, you have a detective, the investigating detective. I mean, it's going to be very impressive and really stout evidence that the investigating detective took the evidence and decided to file a charge against the man. That means it's basically allowing the detective, in a backdoor sort of way, to talk about the hearsay stuff that's in his warrant, and saying, basically, in my opinion, this man's guilty because that's why I filed a charge. And the idea that somehow this is not harmful error, it's just difficult to understand. Again, what they're trying to do when they introduce these kinds of things is harm the defendant. I think they try to say it goes to the point of identity. The detective, who he charged, has nothing to do with identity. That comes from other witnesses at the trial. And to allow them to both try to put somebody like Kerry Pascal and the detective to say, we investigated this and we thought there was something to it, that is very harmful. And the idea that they keep doing it over and over in these cases and allowing this kind of evidence to come in, and then getting away with it by saying somehow it's not harmful, it's just they're going to keep doing it until you make a ruling that this kind of evidence cannot come in to a criminal case, that it's not even the kind of evidence that would even amount to probable cause for an indictment. They're going to keep doing it, and what I would call the kitchen sink process. So we really are serious about asking the court to review that particular issue. With regard to, we have a point seven where we talked about the pen packet. We asked the court, it's a sufficiency of evidence review, but they were having difficulty, obviously, in the record in tying this pen packet to this particular defendant. They use things like what they call the other identifiers, trying to do CID numbers because the fingerprint didn't match up. And it was kind of a totality of circumstances. But we'd asked the court to carefully examine how that evidence was introduced, because it's a very important piece of evidence. If that evidence is excluded, the penalty range is definitely harmful, because instead of being an automatic life, it becomes, I believe it'd be a 5-99 penalty range. So we very much ask the court to review that sufficiency of evidence for admitting the pen pack. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson.
Questions?
Ms. Messerly? Ms. Messerly, would you explain to me why the question and answer that was asked and solicited Ms. Pascal, what's different about that in terms of its relevance and probity from the question asked the detective?
Well, first let me just make sure I clarify. Ms. Pascal was asked the question, however, she didn't answer.
Right.
Correct. The objection was sustained.
I said ask and solicited.
Oh,
I think,
I'm sorry. With this particular case, a little girl made an outcry that she had been sexually assaulted numerous times. The police investigated it, and it was important for the state to show the jury the steps of our investigation. And I believe that's why Ms. Pascal was called, as well as the detective. Ms. Pascal's testimony was very short. If you look at the record, it was basically, did you interview this child? Ms. Pascal is an employee of the DA's office.
I'm not questioning the calling of either witness mm-hmm. for that purpose. My question is, what's the difference between the nature of the question that she was asked, which is, did you provide this information you got, for the purposes of criminal prosecution, and the nature of the question asked the detective, whether after his investigation he took the information he gained and went and filed criminal charges, whatever he said. What's the difference between those two in terms of their relevance?
Well, I think the difference is Ms. Pascal was an investigator, as I just said, for our office. She gathered information. She spoke to the victim. She compiled some information. and passed that on to the detective. She was asked about her interview of Abby, the little girl in this case. The detective did not interview Abby. I think his question goes to getting the information from Pascal, from Miss Pascal, based on her interview with Abby, gathering that information, and then actually going to file charges. I don't think that was Miss Pascal's role, and I don't think the question was directed to her to kind of elicit that testimony.
But the objection to the question that she was asked was relevance, correct?
Correct.
And the same objection was made to the same question, which was answered, relevance to the question asked the detective. And I'm just seeing a real similarity between the two.
I'm wondering why
was one relevant in the mind of the trial judge and one's not relevant? And, you know, that's why the trial judge sustained the objection as to Ms. Pascal.
I understand what you're saying now.
Okay.
As to Ms. Pascal, I think the judge, and you heard what Mr. Henderson said, and maybe the judge was worried that she was going to go into the testimony more directly as to what the child had told her. She had already been deemed not to be an outcry witness. As far as the detective goes, I think it was relevant for him to explain how he had filed charges.
Why?
Because he didn't actually interview Abby herself. He didn't have that opportunity.
But why does the jury need to know that the detective took information he gathered and filed criminal charges against the defendant? Why does the jury need to know that? Isn't that highly prejudicial?
I don't think it's highly prejudicial based on the fact that the jury already knows that an indictment has been filed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they know that. In fact, in the jury instructions from the judge to the jury, the judge clearly says, you know, the indictment should not be considered as evidence of guilt. So I think that takes care of that. But I don't think this could be harmful considering the fact that the jury knows there's already been charges filed or they wouldn't be there in the first place. I think that's pretty, you know, something that the average juror would know. It's just common sense.
Well, I might agree that it's harmless. I might
agree
with that. But I guess I don't want to belabor this.
Sure.
Was it not proper for Ms. Pascal? I assume do you disagree with the ruling the trial court made as to Ms. Pascal? Trial court sustained the objection when the question was asked whether you, after collecting the information and including your interview with Abby, whether you intended to or you did turn it over to law enforcement for purposes of criminal prosecution. Do you think the judge should have let that in?
I think that's relevant information. I think it's relevant to show the steps of the investigation. You know, I agree that based on the court's determination that she wasn't the outcry witness, she probably should not have testified beyond that as to what information she actually elicited from Abby during her interview. But I think it was proper for her to say, yes, she interviewed. I mean, we already know. It was already established that she had interviewed Abby, because there was no objection made prior to that when she's talking about that. So just the fact that she passed on this information for prosecution, I mean, we're in trial at this point. So I do think it's relevant. I think it's relevant to show the steps of the investigation, to show that we conducted a thorough investigation, that it wasn't just based on this little girl's, the things that she told her stepfather. So I think it was proper to show that we conducted a thorough investigation and that we followed the proper steps. Does that help?
I think I know what your thinking is on the relevance of those two questions. But anyway, thank you.
Sure, thank you. But I also wanted to, again, as I said, clarify that she didn't answer the question. The trial court did instruct the jury to disregard the question, and I couldn't find any evidence, and nor did Mr. Henderson point to any evidence that the jury didn't follow the trial court's instruction. Just wanted to touch on that. As far as the detective's answer that, yes, he did file charges, as I've already kind of touched on, I would argue that even if that was error, it's harmless in light of all the testimony that we heard from Abby about the numerous times that she was sexually assaulted by her stepfather. We heard testimony from Dr. Kaufman, who examined her and said that she believed she had been sexually assaulted. And we also heard testimony from Mr. Bretherton, her stepdad. He was the outcry witness, who his testimony essentially mirrored Abby's testimony. So just the fact that the detective filed charges, I think, would be just not really have much of an impact on the jury based on all of the very kind of horrendous evidence they had already heard from those three witnesses. I'm sorry, I thought you were going to ask me a question.
Sorry, I've got a cold, and occasionally I have to clear my throat.
Well, why don't you ask her a question since she's anticipating one?
I also wanted to address the point of error number 7 that Mr. Henderson touched on regarding the pen packet that was admitted. And he is right that the fingerprints on that pen packet, we weren't able, our expert was not able to match those to the appellant. However, we had the appellant's brother testify that he was very aware that the appellant had been convicted of a crime in the 90s, that it was sexual assault, that he had been sent to prison for 7 years, which is exactly what was on the pen packet. But even more than that, he saw the picture that was on the pen packet and very clearly said, that's my brother, I've known him my entire life, that's him. So the state would argue that there was no issue as far as connecting the pen packet to the defendant. And we would argue even more, even if the pen packet had not been admitted, I think the jury still would have convicted this appellant and given him a life sentence. He was convicted not only of 2 counts of indecency with a child, but of aggravated sexual assault of a child, which alone can carry a life sentence. And the reason that I say this is because on the 2 indecency counts, they had the option of convicting or of sentencing appellant from 5 to 99 years. They chose 99 years, and they imposed the maximum fine. So even if this pen packet hadn't been admitted, which I, again, argue that we had proper authentication and we properly connected him, I don't believe the jury would have done anything different based on their sentence on the 2 lesser counts and on the egregious facts of the case. So if there are no further questions, the state would just stand on its brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Messerly.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Henderson?
Once again, Your Honors, if they supposedly have so much other evidence, then why do they call the detective or Ms. Pascal up there to kind of pile on and, you know, and then say, well, we piled on, but it was harmless? I mean, at some point, we've got to say, you can't pile on. And that's why we have raised these points of error. One thing I would reply is that the if the pen packet is kept out, that is one less factor. The fact that the jury doesn't know that he has a prior sexual assault conviction, even if they might not have chosen to give him life on the indecency, and they might really have said, you know, maybe there's some middle ground. But once they found they did have enhancements on the indecency charges that carried up to life. But once they found that he had a prior sexual assault conviction based on this, what we believe is a faulty identification through the pen packet, then it was an automatic life. So they may as well write life in every other blank. So we would allege that if that was left out, there could very well have been a different result. There are no further questions.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
What treatment did you give at trial to the brother's testimony that this is my brother?
Well, I don't know if we asked him a whole lot of questions. The thing that I remember most about what he had to say about his brother is that he went to the Golden Gloves and learned how to fight and knocked him down. They got engaged in fist fights, so, you know, that is one factor that is against us.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate both you coming here this morning to present your arguments. Mr. Henderson, good to see you again.
I'm back in the game.
Yeah, great. Case is submitted, and since we have no other arguments to hear this morning, we'll ask the clerk to adjourn us.